Track 13, James Philippo, Champion of the Jamaican Slaves. This month, our historian takes a look at the life of Dearham-born man who, in the course of liberation, Norfolk can be very proud.
Mrs. Walkup, who called this morning, said that her son, a naval chaplain, was in Jamaica and had become acquainted with a Baptist minister there, who lives in the greatest style. He drives a carriage and pair, keeps riding horses for his daughters, and gives grand dinners. Singularly enough, this person's mother is now living in Dearham. Her name is Philippo, and she keeps one of the lowest chandler's shops in the lowest part of town. So wrote the Dearham diarist Benjamin Armstrong in his diary in February 1855. Neither Armstrong nor his informant may have been fully informed of the history. In fact, James Philippo was himself born in Dearham in 1798 and was to become a much-loved and still-remembered hero in Jamaica. He was the son of a master builder and part owner of an iron foundry. His mother had a family background in farming and retail. He was clearly a bright lad. His early school life was tough, but he proved to have a phenomenal memory and did well academically, though he left school at 13, having experienced life under a headmaster inclined to resort to the use of the cane at the slightest provocation, or no provocation at all. According to a biography published in 1881, written by Edward Bean Underhill, the secretary of the Baptist Missionary Society, beneficiary of all Philippo's papers and diaries, and whom Philippo had asked to publish his story, Philippo had led a fairly rumbustious youth. Despite a family background based on observation of the teachings of the church, he left home and became involved with unsuitable company, indulging in what his biographer describes as a career of worldliness and sin. This included abusing practicing Methodists in the street and breaking up their worship. The early stages of the biography have almost a Bunyan-esque tone to them, with Philippo portrayed as a doppelganger for Christian in Pilgrim's Progress, as he hears a voice of thunder which summoned him to repent and led him, after fighting through his own slough of despond, as his conscience fought with his inclination, to emerge a fully committed Christian with a particular interest in the role of missionary. At the age of 21, he applied to the Baptist Missionary Society, the BMS, and underwent training in both Oxfordshire and at a college in Bradford, preparatory to taking up a missionary role. However, the BMS had a strong reference for its missionaries to be married before taking up their posts, perhaps uncomfortably aware of the temptations which might arise for naive young men from a conventional background. And in 1823, James married Hannah Cecil, a fellow Baptist he had met during his training in Oxfordshire. Later that year, they travelled together to Jamaica to take up his first post at the island's capital, Spanish Town. Certainly, it was no sinecure. The environment was almost entirely hostile. Neither the government nor the planters had any inclination to encourage the missionaries. Indeed, the latter were strongly opposed to the idea that the slave should receive any religious education at all. In order to preach, it was necessary to have a license, and such was not given lightly. It took until 1825 for James to receive his, by which time, according to one Jamaican source, he had already been jailed for preaching without one. Another source claims that he received death threats from the planters, whose concern was that if the slaves were given education and introduced to Christianity, they might be even more dissatisfied with their lot and become rebellious. With something in the order of 300,000 slaves on the island, this was a huge threat, not just to the livelihoods of the planters, but also to their physical safety and to that of their families. The missionaries were seen as supporters of the anti-slavery campaign and out to ruin the local economy. James took risks, preaching to enthusiastic congregations in the area where the ban on preaching without a license was less likely to be an issue. Once he had a license, he could preach freely. And his sermons were heard with great enthusiasm by congregations comprising almost exclusively of the slave population. His theme that salvation was open to all, the enslaved as well as the free, created hope. James had not only trained as a missionary, But he had also learned a little of some useful trades, such as building. He had worked briefly with his father's business before he went off the rails. With huge energy supplemented by the extra skills he had learnt, and with financial support from England, he built, with the aid of church members, a new chapel large enough to hold a congregation of more than 1,500, and set out to build schools as well. In 1827, he built the chapel in Spanish Town, still known today as the Filippo Baptist Church. Soon he was having to build additional facilities, as well as schools. By 1831, he was exhausted, and his health was suffering. He came home to England with his wife and children, one of whom died on the voyage, for rest and recuperation. He probably got little of either, addressing meetings and generally canvassing for his cause. A series of four lectures he gave in Norwich at the invitation of J.J. Gurney was said to be especially influential. News of them reached Jamaica, prompting one of his colleagues there to write to him, suggesting he deferred his return until the dust they had stirred up had settled. His return to England meant that he missed the Christmas Rebellion in December that year. It's no surprise that the rebellion became known as the Baptist War. It was the idea of Baptist slaves, led by a Baptist deacon, planned following a Baptist prayer meeting, and required planners to swear an oath on the Bible to carry out the agreed plans. Thousands of slaves were believed to have taken part. On Christmas Day, the leaders went on strike, demanding both a wage and more free time. The planters refused their demands, and 2 days later, violence erupted. At one plantation, the crops were set on fire and the whites fled. The unrest rapidly spread to other plantations. Somehow, some of the slaves had contrived to arm themselves. They were known as the Black Regiment. One group managed to put to flight a regiment of militia, and the victors went on the rampage, setting fire to more crops and recruiting additional rebels. The rebellion was put down promptly, and the leaders executed. The reaction of the planters was predictable, placing blame on the Baptist missionaries and exacting revenge by destroying about 10 Baptist chapels. At the same time, the possible abolition of slavery was under review in Parliament, and in 1833, the Emancipation Act was passed, though it didn't immediately enfranchise the entire slave population. Instead, it was decided that the slaves needed first to learn how to be free, so a system known as apprenticeship was established. This meant that the former slaves were required for up to 5 years to continue to work for 45 hours a week for their former masters without pay, while plans were implemented for them to be housed and educated as free men. This wasn't just patronizing. It was designed to enable the planters to continue to operate profitably. Some saw it as simply replacing one form of slavery with another. Even Lord Derby, later Prime Minister on three occasions, described it so. In 1833, Filippo set out for Jamaica, but didn't arrive after a very rough passage until March 1834, when he received a rapturous welcome. His return coincided with the appointment of a new governor, the second Marquess of Sligo. The planters were delighted by the appointment, especially as Sligo was himself the owner of two plantations on the island. They were to be disappointed. He had received the plantations as an inheritance and was certainly not in favour of the way they were run. He was much of the same mind as Filippo, and together they set out to create an environment in which the apprenticeship could be shortened. Sligo was not popular either with the planters or the local legislature, but he was of valuable support to Filippo. With other Baptist missionaries, Filippo came up with the idea of free villages, where enfranchised former slaves could build a new life. Acquiring the land to build these was not easy, not just because of the cost, but particularly because the owners would not knowingly sell for the purpose he intended. Filippo solved these issues by a combination of fundraising from sympathisers in Britain, loans, and subterfuge. He must by this time have acquired some wealth, because he personally stood surety for the loans. He employed agents, recruited on a confidential basis, to act as purchasers. His plans were ambiguous. He planned schools and chapels in the new communities. The first to be completed was, with a nod to the supportive governor, named Sligoville. Sligerville was built on 25 acres of land near the governor's mansion, acquired by Filippo for £100, and divided into plots of a quarter of an acre, which were sold to ex-slaves for £3 each. Filippo also built a school and a chapel in the village. It became the model for other communities on the island built by him and by other missionaries as full emancipation eventually arrived. It may be that the son of Mrs. Walkup, Armstrong's informant, was correct in his assessment of Filippo's wealth and social position. The ability to stand surety for those loans certainly implies so. But this was more than 30 years after Filippo's arrival in Jamaica. In the interim, his achievements on behalf of the oppressed, his strategic skills in catering for their housing and education, and his introduction of the Christian faith, all in the teeth of strong and sometimes violent opposition, weigh heavily on the credit side of the balance sheet. Norfolk can be as proud of James Filippo in the cause of liberation as it can of its more famous adopted son, Thomas Fowell Buxton.